Good afternoon. Welcome. I'm Rick Barton. I'm the co-director of the Post-Conflict Reconstruction Project here at CSIS with Karen von Hippel. And very pleased to have you here this afternoon for what we expect will be a fresh look at Afghanistan. I see many familiar faces. You've had a chance to hear many of the same people, and we've had a chance to hear each other. And I think what's particularly appealing about this afternoon is we're going to hear some fresh voices that have spent a great deal of time in Afghanistan, but have not really been heard in this marketplace as much. Obviously, Alex has probably been seen more. He just came back from a recent trip. He was there in January and February, I think was what he said. And Gabrielle has been out there for really the last 4 years, but left in January and has been here in the United States for the most of the last couple of months. And Dipali was there almost, I guess, a year and a half or so ago, but has really made this the center of her study. There are a couple of advertisements I'd like to get out of the way. The first is we've just recently come out with an update to our Sudan report that many of you may want to see. It's online. It's a very concise report that was the lead author was Karen von Hippel. She'd been out there recently with Rebecca Linder, who's right here. And so I hope you'll have a chance to find that online. And then also, for those of you who do not have In the Balance, which was really our effort last year to try to measure progress in Afghanistan, that is available from our publications office right outside the door here. And we'd be happy to have you either purchase a copy, or if you're indigent, we'll take care of getting you a copy, whichever way is going to be most likely to have you read it. What we'd like to do today's forum, please feel free to take seats at the table. There's really no reserve seating. Is to have each of our presenters speak for about 7 minutes, and then really have much more of an open discussion. And so that is the program for the day. We'll just go in the order that they appear in the program. Alex will go first, Dipali will go second, and Gabrielle will go last. So I think just to get started, that's pretty much the introduction, and look forward to the discussion. We'll finish up here around 3:30.
Thanks a lot to Rick and the really great team that you have as part of the PCR project. They've consistently put out such great material, which for those of us who work in the field always comes as a needed and welcome supply of information. As I was thinking about what I was going to say today, I went back and flipped through some of the In the Balance report, and I'll get to specifically, but some of the work that they did last year has really held up as being, I think, very prescient in terms of the problems and prospects that Afghanistan now has. You know, the thing that I think I was most struck with in this last trip is what a remarkable moment Afghanistan is facing right now. The new parliament had just been seated. Obviously, the new constitution has been sort of technically in place for over a year, but really the main branches of the government are just now being filled out with the recent elections for the new parliament, the provincial councils. Obviously, the president's office is really up and running now. For where Afghanistan has been, I lived through 4 years of the Civil War in the 1990s, and that's very much my lens on Afghanistan, witnessing the sort of ultimate disintegration of the state. And so it really is an amazing moment to see these pieces coming together and to see how the Afghans are really trying to make a go of putting their political system back together. But while you have that, the other remarkable side of there being an incredible amount of government right now in Afghanistan is that there is still a strikingly limited amount of governance. I had the opportunity to travel to a couple of different provinces in a process where we're bringing together local state actors, state officials in the justice sector, together with non-state actors, people who are prominent in their communities, and shuras and jirgas. to look at sort of the state of the justice sector and a little bit more broadly, the state of local governance. And it is not a pretty picture. One of the fears that I have, having come back from this recent trip, is that whereas in the past when you traveled, people were hopeful about government and expectant of the outcomes of the government, and not yet disenchanted with the potential for government. And what I think we saw on this trip is that the attempts to establish local government in Afghanistan are not going forward demonstrably for most people, and that creates a real danger. And I wanted to read to you, because this was sort of part of what we had said we were going to talk about today, the ANDS, the Afghan National Development Strategy, says right up front, the state does not yet have the capacity or resources to govern effectively. It mobilizes less domestic resources as a percentage of GDP than any other state in the world for which data are available. And that is immediately evident if you travel outside of the capital. But I think that the problem that this highlights is not only that there are not sufficient resources going into local government. It is that in some ways the vision of the state, which was promulgated through the constitutional process and has been the sort of core of the state building process in the last 4 years, is an extremely Kabul-centric one. And the danger of that is that the regions have in many ways been ignored, and the people who managed to assert control in the early days after the collapse of the Taliban have become entrenched in a way that is fundamentally dangerous to the establishment of governance in Afghanistan. And that question has really yet to be tackled effectively. And for me, it becomes a question the extent to which this is true only because of the failings of the intervention, or whether we've in some ways sort of are not still appropriately approaching the question of governance as it needs to be in Afghanistan in 2006, which is a very different world than Afghanistan in 1967 or 1973. And I use those times because that's really the last time when constitutional government was operating in Afghanistan. But we're dealing with a very different country. And I think that the people who think that those with a contrary vision of Afghanistan, contrary to what the current state looks like, are going to sort of go slowly or quietly into the night should take another puff of their opium pipe. Because Afghanistan faces some enormous hurdles, and it's not just from the Taliban, it's not just from opium trafficking, it's very much from people who are considered to be within the tent. It's from clerics who, in fact, do believe that people who convert to Christianity should be put to death. It's from regional power holders who, while they proclaim their fealty to the government, still continue to act contrary to that goal. It's from similarly not only warlords but tribal leaders, people who have never really envisioned themselves as part of the state but envision themselves as standing somewhat outside the state. They make bargains with the state but don't consider themselves under the control of the central government. And so all of the old struggles that Afghanistan faced before this horrific round of 30 years of fighting and upheaval still exist in terms of making Afghanistan into a state. The intervention, and tell me how I'm doing on time, I don't want to go too long. The intervention is also reaching a very dangerous point from a broader perspective. All of us who have read the type of literature, such as the stuff that Paul Collier did at the World Bank, and that have looked at sort of interventions across different countries, both time and space, realize that these types of interventions tend to be very time limited, both in terms of the amount of resources that are available and the amount of political attention that's available to do the really hard work of an early intervention. And Afghanistan is reaching that moment where the world's attention and the world's resources may turn elsewhere. And if there are real fundamental problems that have yet to be resolved, then that presents a challenge for Afghanistan in the long term. The Kabul Compact or the London Compact process was obviously a very serious and important attempt to counter that trend, but it has yet, I think, to be seen if that's going to have a meaningful impact. The two specific areas that I will mention before turning it over to Dipali that I think are fundamental to Afghanistan's future and I think have come out the worst so far in the state-building process are the judicial system or the legal system more broadly and provincial and local government, which I mentioned. As far as the judicial system is obviously one of the best weeks that one could have made this point. Rule of law, I think, above anything else, is ultimately the test that we are going to look at, that the coalition is going to look at as the sort of tipping point whether the intervention succeeds and when we can ultimately think about leaving a self-sustaining Afghan state. And that is clearly not possible without a competent, coherent, and legitimate justice system. There is no country in history, including our own, that has come through political crises in which you are both testing the power of the system to defend the weak and to constrain the strong without a judicial system in place that has independent actors that whose ultimate fealty is actually to the rule of law and not to faction or not to ideology. And Afghanistan is so far from that place right now. As far as specifically on the Rahman case, it's interesting that, in some ways, court dramas are a positive thing. We're not talking about a guy who was taken out and stoned to death in a village by a mob, which is a positive thing. You want people arguing about what the actual indictment said. You know, what is the basis in the Constitution that they're going to find to hang this guy? So there are some maybe silver linings to the distastefulness of this sort of particular case. And one of the ironies, of course, of this outcome is that when pressed, President Karzai first stood up and said, according to our Constitution, we have an independent judiciary. And the telephone justice that we're always decrying here was actually our telephones ringing in Kabul saying, I don't care what you do, but let this guy go. And that may have been the right decision in this case, but it still was a dramatic case of telephone justice intervening into the judicial system. And what that tells me is that our points of pressure and our focus on the system are really backwards. We need to be working on the justice sector in Afghanistan in a meaningful way on a day-to-day basis on issues that aren't going to bring people out into the streets. And unfortunately, our intervention has been relatively weak in this area. We haven't devoted much resources to it. We've devoted no political attention to it. And as a result, we've ended up, and President Karzai has ended up with the judiciary in some ways that we see today. The ANDS, again, says that there's a pervasive culture of impunity existing in Afghanistan due to a lack of an independent judiciary and professional law enforcement. These are the words of the Afghan government themselves, and so they certainly are aware of the problem, but they have not themselves taken hold of this issue or devoted the resources to do it. And I just want to say that the CASIS report on In the Balance rated the justice sector pillar as by far the worst that they found in their look at Afghanistan. This was both through their interviews and talking to people and through the wider sort of polling data that they did. And I can say from my last visit, if this data was done over a year ago, it's only gotten worse. People simply do not use the justice system in Afghanistan. They view it as corrupt and incompetent, and therefore they're voting with their feet and going into alternative means, which are usually private, community-based resolution, which in some ways is very positive, but it certainly doesn't help the government to become a credible and competent government. There is a moment of opportunity now. A new Supreme Court is being appointed along with a new cabinet. Unfortunately, the Chief Justice who has been in charge of the courts, at least under President Karzai's proposal, is remaining in place, which I think is deeply problematic. I've spoken to some of the other justices which have been appointed underneath him. They were extremely reluctant to take those positions because they don't feel that reform is going to be possible under him. That being said, some of about seven of the other eight people I actually have fairly positive reports on. So there is some hope for engagement, I think, with the court. And I'll just wind up by saying on the provincial government side of things, you know, the message that we were really getting from people in the field is that the musical warlords game is getting old. The process of moving people around from different governorships to different governorships or sub-governorships or making the sort of the worst actors or their cronies, the police chiefs in various provinces, you know, simply has eroded deeply the confidence of the government. I don't need to say Minister Jalali is sitting here. He may have a question or a comment about this. But in many ways, here's somebody who staked their life and their reputation in response to this issue. So we understand how grave it is. There is still a crisis of impunity in Afghanistan, but it's not with the worst guys, the guys that you know from their name, from reading the papers. I mean, they're a problem. But the real crisis for people in an immediate sense is these guys at the local level, because they have been left untouched. Even when governors are replaced, the power structures that exist in those provinces don't evaporate. The daily problems that people are facing are with the same guys. They may not have official titles anymore, although many of them still do. But there is still a real crisis at the local level, and that's what people are suffering from. And ultimately, that's what people are using to judge their confidence in this government. And if the government does not come through with greater legitimacy in the next year or two, then it is really going to be very far behind.
Great. Thanks very much. Can you pass this?
Sure.
Thank you. Actually, my comments are going to jump right off of what Alex has just said. I just first want to thank Rick Barton and Rebecca for organizing this and inviting me to be included. The relationship between Afghans and the structures that govern them has a long and complicated history, the exploration of which may shed some light on the challenge to cultivate governance and the rule of law. The particularities of local governance in Afghanistan may, in fact, have the most to tell us about the state-building process in this country. I'm working on a paper right now with a colleague of mine at the Fletcher School that attempts to unpack the relationship between the state and the citizen at the local level. As all of you know, the Afghan Compact has placed significant emphasis on the cultivation of effective and legitimate governance, with particular reference to public administration reform, anti-corruption measures, respect for human rights, and access to justice. I believe the Compact has identified many of the critical elements necessary for higher functioning state governance, but many questions remain pressing and unanswered. Several observers of the Afghan political scene, including AREU's Andrew Wilder and Sarah Lister, have exposed for us a number of pathologies that continue to weaken the ability of the state to govern at the local level. Local and provincial commanders maintain power and influence over government employees, many of whom receive subsidies in their salary from these individuals to compensate for their meager pay. Of course, the revenue that supports these warlords can often be traced to their involvement in illicit economies, including the opium trade. They're able, therefore, not only to assert their independence from the state, but they provide goods and services within their spheres of influence to maintain loyalty. Wilder and Lister conclude that the Afghan state has a long way to go before it can connect with its citizens at the local level. In fact, they fear that the very credibility of state governance may be jeopardized if Afghans associate local administration with weakness, corruption, and ineptitude. As a counterpoint, they argue that Afghans believe in the notion of central authority and, in fact, have a, quote, strong attachment to the idea of central government. But the key question remains, what means exist to harness the theoretical legitimacy of the state in order to make governance a reality on the ground? To begin to probe this, let's consider some Afghan political history in order to appreciate the degree to which this very question has perplexed Afghan rulers, citizens, and scholars for quite some time. Anthropologist David Katz, who studied the region of Nuristan during the 1970s, argued that many of the Afghans he observed felt a strong affinity for the central government. It was largely responsible for bringing peace to the region after years of insecurity, and through networks of patronage, this region at the periphery of the state became bound to the center. While the Afghans Khat studied felt allegiance to their state, in practice they desired a strong degree of independence from the state and sought its intervention only in limited terms. In 1972, Richard Newell described the degree to which the state's penetration represented for many Afghans a foreign intrusion characterized by the imposition of what he called a bureaucratized, inexperienced, and centrally controlled administration made up primarily of urban Pashtun elites. It's important to notice, therefore, that these local administrative structures often did not resonate with the background and customs of many Afghans. As Shahranish suggests, the ties between the states and its people were often largely inorganic. From Abdurrahman's regime onwards, therefore, informal institutions governed in parallel with the state, often with greater legitimacy and effectiveness. As scholars like Barfield and Shahrani observed, while local administrators represented the state, at the local level, many of them did not govern with great knowledge or authority. Instead, they often employed tribal leaders as intermediaries. The building of the state, as exemplified by the maintenance of the rule of law, the collection of revenue, and the conscription of troops, could not have been pursued by the central government without the support of tribal leadership. In certain parts of the country, the tribal authorities remained at the helm entirely and operated outside the bounds of the state's authority altogether. Official channels of government were frequently associated with high rates of corruption, inefficiency, cultural difference, and therefore illegitimacy. The act of governing Afghans remained as much or more in the hands of informal power holders as it did in the hands of the local administrative instruments of the state. My own experience with the Aga Khan Development Network in Badakhshan made clear to me the continuing importance of informal actors in the landscape of local governance. In a survey taken by Afghan staff working for AKDN throughout the province in 2004, there was some good news for the government. The local government representative was identified as the most significant recipient of conflict referrals. In other words, conflict management had largely shifted from the sphere of violence to the realm of the state in areas where the state administrator, or Woli Swol, had credibly established itself. The acknowledgement of the government's role in conflict management, however, did not preclude a tremendous emphasis on the part of 2004 survey and workshop participants with whom I worked on informal power structures. Not unlike the findings Shahrani reached several decades before, participants in 2004 identified one of the most significant, quote, peace potentials in the province to be local elders. Their interventions in conflict related to natural resources and power politics were cited as critical to preventing conflict escalation and ultimately bringing about conflict resolution in a number of cases. Religious leaders were also referenced as influential in various arenas of conflict, in particular those surrounding opium production and consumption. But these leaders were also identified in many cases as instigators of conflict, and their political ideologies and approach could infrequently be characterized as inclusive or participatory. The National Solidarity Program, for which AKDN is a facilitating partner, represents a fascinating experiment that has taken on the challenge of governance, both formal and informal. A nationally driven reconstruction project, it operates at the intersection of economics and politics by enabling local communities to elect councils that manage development projects and while doing so create linkages with the state. Some councils have certainly represented new arenas of power for warlords and commanders to assert themselves in old ways. But they have also provided an opportunity for communities to elect new leaders who exercise a new kind of power through a state-based institution vis-a-vis those who had maintained informal control before. Tribal elders and religious leaders can engage and participate within these councils, but the youth and women who have a newfound access to the political sphere will likely provide a check on the power and ideas of this old guard. It remains to be seen whether these councils will amount to old wine in new bottles or whether they will herald a new era for local governance in Afghanistan. Through my remarks, I hope to draw attention to the kinds of questions and dilemmas these observations provoke. Does it make sense for a country whose state has achieved limited local legitimacy in history to move down a path away from informal structures and institutions? While some of these informal institutions and actors may represent credible governors on the ground, do their laws and customs resonate with our, quote, universal conceptions of human rights and the rule of law? Is the international community willing to begin to reconceive of a post-conflict state-building model that incorporates informal sectors of governance? To what extent can informal actors and institutions be drawn into the process of formal governance without overwhelming it with their own ideas and interests that may in fact threaten underlying norms and goals of the state-building agenda? And finally, does the Afghanistan Compact acknowledge its own country's history of politics, power, and governance? Does it represent a pragmatic way forward or an idealistic model that remains more a pipe dream than a roadmap ahead? As I'm an academic and a student, I have many more questions than answers, but I hope we can take some of these up in the discussion. Thanks.
Well, thank you, of course, for the invitation. I also wanted to thank CSIS and Rick for the report done last year in Afghanistan, because I believe it brings new voices and a new approach to the way that things are going in Afghanistan. I remember we met in Kabul a year ago when we were preparing the team of researchers for the balance, and the interesting note on that is that these people were just people from different levels of the community. What they did is go and talk to people and bring the voices, the access to the real opinion that people might say, to common, to people who look like them, who speak like them. So this is why I think the result of the report brings a new approach. Most of the past 4 years, I was on the field working for programs on elections, awareness, on civic education, on ANA, which is the Afghan National Army, explanation of what it is, on anti-poppy, also public information and rule of law. And one of the things I learned during that time is a word combination, in English would be something like manage expectations. Because at the end of the day, when you are implementing, you are there and the people see you as the one who should deliver. So the main concept to stick was manage expectations. When we read right now about the new phase of for Afghanistan, the ANDS, 5 years to come, I think it will be a real challenging time on managing expectations, especially that compared to the previous years, to the Bonn Agreement step, right now there is no, this new phase is not event-driven, and this is something that for people matters. I mean, talking to people on the streets or with normal people in Afghanistan, what they would say is during those 4 years, the elections, presidential and parliamentary, whatever they went to, they meant for them something. It was like almost like a catalysis for their expectations. This new phase is no event-driven. I mean, it's less things that will be tangible for the people in which they can load their expectations. Another layer of the management of expectations is that the achievement during the Bonn Agreement are not going to be effective anymore. I mean, people during the past 4 years would talk about raising school enrollment from 900,000 to 5 million, I think, the new roads, the new currency. Well, the equivalence to those achievements in this new phase will not have the same positive vibe within the community. So again, it will be a very challenging moment to manage those expectations. A short note on this is that I spend a lot of time in the universities. We had a program in seven universities across the country, so I spend a lot of time with the youth. And I was talking only a year ago before the first generation of graduates from university post-Taliban come out. I was talking with a woman called Sohaila, which is she's in the medical school of Herat. And she was talking that the government is putting energy and money for returnees, is putting energy and money for people who were mujahideens with the DDR programs. They are putting money even for farmers who had been growing poppy, and now as an award for stop growing poppy, they give them money. And she, a woman from Herat, said, I spent the last 4 years studying here, and I don't think I'm going to get a job. And just a small note on that, because there will be 100,000, according to the Ministry of Higher Education figures, of graduates this year who are going to be facing a lot of frustration because there are no jobs for them. There are international community, there are UN agencies, NGOs, people who will probably take the smarters, doctors to work as whatever, in the office or in the administrative side. Some people in the capital might take some jobs, but the core part of that new generation is going to grow frustration in the next 5 years because there is no enough market and it's not going to work for them. And this is something that I would not disregard as an important element of the next 5 years to come. What to do about it? I don't know. I mean, there is no serious national program to promote jobs for youth or for university graduates. That's maybe a sector to take a look at. Basically, when we talk about the challenges to come, I think I agree with Alexander and with Dipali on what they were saying. I think I see four specific sectors in which the main challenges will be, and those pillars, more than during the bond process years, needs to be mutually reinforced. It will condition each other. For me, those four pillars are governance, as Alexander and Dipali pointed out. I think that there is now a national government, there is a parliament. The justice sector needs to be stronger, and with the provincial councils or the local governments, there needs to be a big effort on that sector. The second main pillar is security. I mean, many things are going on in the last months or in the last week. 2005 was the deadliest year since 2001, and many things are happening. We can speak broader maybe later. I'm sure people know a lot of what is going on. U.S. Is thinking about retreating military presence. The British are going to deploy a team in Helmand, and what I see as a good sign is that the Afghan government is pushing harder into the relationship with Pakistan to get support from Pakistan to grab and to work more on the intelligence side. So security is, for me, the second big pillar. The third one is the economic growth. I think what they are expecting is to reduce poverty by 15%. They're talking about people living under $1 per day. They want to reduce that 3% per year. The Asian Development Bank is proposing a few different programs to increase the private sector. And this is going to be, again, everything is mutually reinforced with each other, with each of the other pillars. And the fourth one is the poppy issue. And again, it has to do with the economy, it has to do with the security, and it has to do with the governance. So far, I actually was in Lashkargah 6-7 months ago, which is the capital of Helmand, when Helmand province is producing 25% of the poppy of the world, just the province. And there is a big mess going on right now in terms of what is called alternative livelihoods and what people is expecting. And I come again to manage expectations, because farmers are getting more and more frustrated of new programs and people coming to work on the poppy issue and not being able to deliver the alternative that they have been promised. So to try to be very, very strict in the expectations of the people and to try to manage that, because Afghanistan will have a very, very difficult time to reduce the traffic of opium. And I think the main goal right now in the sector is to actually prevent Afghanistan to become a narco state, which is far from reducing, still far from reducing the trafficking. The note on that for Afghanistan is that still the drug lords have not put some of the money that they are making back into the community, because that will create what it is actually an anarcho state, like in Colombia, where people 15 years ago will speak about anarcho Pablo Escobar almost as God, because he was putting money in hospital, in orphanage, building schools, so the community feel more represented, more protected, and better with someone who spend money on them than with a central government. So on the opium and on that drug issue, I think that's the key issue. I mean, try to prevent, before reducing and talking about figures, try to prevent Afghanistan to become a narco state, because then it's going to be much more difficult.
Why don't we move right to your questions and comments, and let's make this as much of a discussion as possible. If I could ask you when I call on you to just tell us who you are and to limit your remarks to a minute or two, preferably with a question associated with it. The question was just asked by one of the panelists, are we on the record or off the record? We're on the record today, for those of you who don't know.
Mr. Peer, question is, of course, this is a week for judicial politics in Afghanistan, and I'm just wondering to what extent do you see this as perhaps, you know, shock that politics are alive and well in Afghanistan, and do you believe this is an attempt for forces in the parliament locally to look, is it a cross-cutting movement, or is it specific to the Chief Justice, and does he have a larger following on this?
Well, this case, I mean, raised some fascinating issues, both broadly and in terms of what's happening right now in Afghan politics. Broadly, it obviously raised the issue so clearly, you couldn't have come up with a better case as to the tensions that exist within the Afghan legal system and in the Afghan constitution between the sort of Western values or democratic values that it ascribes on one hand, and the fact that it is an Islamic constitution. Afghanistan is an Islamic state, and there has always been in Afghanistan's legal system room for judges to engage in interpretation of the Islamic Sharia in particular types of cases, and this case fell perfectly foursquare into that area. And so, in many ways, it's an important case to have come up. It's actually not the first time that this issue has been raised. A few months ago, there was also a case with a journalist who was accused of blasphemy for having written, basically for having questioned some of the Quranically prescribed punishments. And he was at first indicted under a possible death sentence and then was imprisoned for 3 months and then eventually released. And so it's a very active issue. As far as the specific way that it plays into Afghan politics right now, as best as I can understand, I don't think that this case was ginned up in the sense that there have been a number of cases in the last couple of years that have been ginned up by people in the Supreme Court, where they sort of look at something that's happening out there and they bring it to the fore and to national attention because they want to beat the issue with the Islamic stick. It doesn't seem to me from everybody that I've talked to in Kabul that, that the case originally arose that way. However, once it did arise, obviously, it became immediately a tug of war between people who are interested right now in demonstrating their power, both within the judiciary and within the National Assembly. The reason that Chief Justice Shinwari is in place, in my estimation, is well, there is a lot of reasons, but one of the main reasons is that President Karzai believes that he has a somewhat weak Islamic flank and that Shinwari represents a certain amount of protection for him. In exchange for him being allowed to remain in place, Shinwari, and also through his council of ulama, the council of clerics that he runs, which is a sort of odd quasi-state institution, they harp on these issues because they believe that it strengthens their hand in the current power struggle in Afghanistan between the forces of modernization and the forces of conservatism. And this case has fanned those flames considerably. And the fact that it rose so quickly to such a high international level is going to be a problem for Karzai, because the fact that President Bush said something and the fact that the Secretary of State, along with other presidents of other countries, openly acknowledges having called the presidential palace and said, let this man go, and the fact that he was let go and is now in Italy, looks like to us what it looks like to them, that Karzai was told what to do and he did it. And that does not bode well for his standing, particularly with those who want to undermine the legitimacy of the government.
Yes.
Philip Dine, St. Louis Post-Dispatch. I was in Afghanistan this month in Ken Hart and Helmand. If anything, I think you might have understated the role of Helmand province in the world's population. Almost half. In any case, I'm wondering if you could say something about the poppy situation from two perspectives. One, how big a threat it poses in context to Afghanistan becoming a successful state. And secondly, if you could assess the efforts of the U.S. government to combat the opium trade, be it from education or alternate lifestyles or eradication, interdiction, and prosecution.
Yeah, at one point, when the international community sort of divide a major task, and the counter-narcotics desk was for the British, though the United States had different programs on counter-narcotics. I have worked on the sector for some time, and what we see is that there are like between 2 and 3 years to make sure that Afghanistan does not become an anarcho state, and that's the prime goal right now. And there are many things going on. I mean, one of the main problems to achieve results on the sector is that the alternative livelihood has become a problem difficult to handle. Why? Because farmers in regions where they were not growing poppy, they started to grow poppy so that they could get the alternative livelihood, so that they can be awarded for growing poppy. So another case, a group of farmers in Helmand, they are suing the British government for $21 million for a program that they claim to have. It was in 2002. They claimed that a British government went there and promised $350 per jarbia, which is like a parcel for growing. And they claimed that was never paid. So the alternative livelihoods is actually can be detrimental for the whole program. A major change on that would probably lead to work on programs which are actually not called alternatives, that are just or alternative livelihoods, that are just supporting the rural community by building bridges, by building irrigation systems, and in some places to find a seed to replace. Right now, as you probably have seen in Kandahar and Helmand, the main problem is there, but also in the north, in Badakhshan, there is an important sector with poppy cultivation, and in some regions in Masar. Otherwise, is very much in Nangarhar, Helmand, Farah, and Kandahar.
I did a little bit of work on migrant workers in Badakhshan who were participating in the cultivation process. And I think that Gabriel's point is very important, and it came out in the compact that narcotics cross all sectors in terms of the impact that they have and the way in which they need to be, counter-narcotics needs to be approached. Aga Khan, for example, was, rather than focusing on alternative livelihoods per se, was looking at the deeper roots of why individuals are participating in the poppy cultivation, and found, for example, with these migrants that we were looking at, that their levels of education were so low, their access to healthcare was so limited, that they really had there were no other options to them, and these cycles were not going to be shifted unless much deeper programming was done to think about education, healthcare, and things like building roads so that individuals could actually have access outside of very remote areas in more than a few months of the year. They also found, and ARU has also done some work on this, that the rule of law and the ability of individuals to get out of cycles of debt, to have property rights, all of these things are connected with the entrapment that seems to exist in terms of lower level individuals who are not in fact profiting in any significant way from participating in cultivation.
Marvin Weinbaum, Middle East Institute. Gabriel, two questions here. I was intrigued by your statement here that the drug traffickers perhaps should be investing in their own community. And that worries me, because I think if I envision a narco state, it's where, in effect, the major traffickers supplant the government, that they have resources well beyond what the government can invest in that particular area. And that, together with building drug armies, then we'll know we're really in a drug state. So that I'd like your comment. Also, one other thing, manage expectations. Yes. I wonder, though, whether at the same time we don't have to manage our own expectations. We just saw this with this here. We have established the bar at a particular level here. And very little comprehension here of the system, of perhaps finding a way for the system to make the compromises, to make the adjustments, so that whether it's here or not just our expectations for human rights, but also our expectations, perhaps even for the judiciary. It's never going to have anything which resembles what we would like it to be. So I think that we're going to have to work on that as well.
Thank you. I start by the second point. I fully agree with you, and I actually think that's what we should be doing. But what I was saying is mostly from my role or my work, when you are there, you have to manage their expectation, because you are dealing with you are an implementer, and you just have to go there and work and try to get things done. And with that hat, which is the only one that I have now, so you have to deal with the day-to-day life of the people, and that's part of what I have to learn to do. I mean, try to make programs be successful by managing the expectation of the people. Probably the government should be, when you say we have to be managing our expectations, I agree. Again, I mean, probably the government has to, or the international community has to, or even some of the people who are working on designing the strategies for the future. Yeah. On the first thing, it's funny because I was a journalist for so many years, and I usually take bites and put them in what I want. I mean, I don't know if you understood or I said that the narcos has to build their own economy, or they have to put money into the community. I was just making a reference to the worst scenario, and the first priority, in my opinion, for these counter-narcotic programs, which is to prevent that to happen. And there are a lot of efforts being made. And I was pointing Colombia because it's a country where I have worked, and there it's much more ugly. I mean, it's really ugly because, as you said, there are then not only the little warlords or drug lords, but also the armies, and it's like even currency systems. Even, I mean, it's like breaking the country into different pieces. So there are efforts being made, and one of them is working on that. The other way is another one is trying to promote a better education of what is going on with the alternatives, with the rural development. This is specifically the sector that I'm working on, which is public information, and just try to raise the awareness of the farmers of what is going on, really, to first let them know what is going on, but then also try to make some behavior changing through opinion leaders who might be the people in the villages, in the shuras, in the remote areas. And another sector, just to finish with this, another sector which a lot of efforts are being made is in working on the borders with the trafficking, which I think is in the hands of Germans on the northern part. I mean, because most of that is going to the former Soviet republics, and then on to Europe, because all those efforts have to be coordinated and work at the same time. And why not at one stage is also work with a very solid and clear strategy on the demand, which is here in the United States and in Europe. That's probably one of the most challenging, and that's what I started with. I mean, the difference with the 4 years during the bond process, when they were more event or different, I don't know if you call them catalysts for the expectations, and now you have less. And then you also, as it happened in other places in the world, when the international community moves from post-conflict to development, it becomes a huge vacuum to work with. And it's not going to happen. I mean, development is not going to happen in 5 years, I don't think. I mean, cases Bosnia or Haiti, or it's not going to happen. And so this is, if the way I see it, is like it's more a challenge, and it's more something to learn for this new phase. Because again, it's going to be much more difficult than the one before. Maybe reformulating the values for success for the international community. I mean, maybe think about the success in other terms than the ones that we would use during the first pass. The bond process.
Because we have grown tired of you, and they are growing tired of us, and yet we simply have to learn how to listen to them and build relationships and find people who are willing to work in these fields. And James Klugner has recently made the comment that it's increasingly difficult to find Americans to go out with AID and others. But the cultural values of that country are paramount, and they pose difficulties for us. We are not going to be successful unless we listen and have the three cups of tea. And yes, the ALP, unfortunately, may be a mess now, but how could we possibly imagine that in a very short period of time we were going to find alternative sources of income for people with 8, 10, 12 children who are earning only $200 a year in the regular fashion? We have to be realistic. And then I'll pose a question, I guess. None of you has mentioned the value of education. Just what are your thoughts on education? How important is that for the future of that country?
Just before that, on the alternative livelihoods, I think you made a very important comment, because the first program, and especially as a relief or as a post-conflict reaction, it was actually that. I mean, it was just replacing the poppy by in the short run. But now, I mean, when the phase is development, the policies might be looking at a longer term alternative, which is actually right, not always a replacing seed, but other structures.
First, I just want to address your point about culture, because I think it's very important. And I had the privilege of my first experience working in Afghanistan to be with an organization, Aga Khan, which truly prioritized long-term strategic thinking. Projects where timelines extend for decades, and the staff is primarily Afghan, and meetings were always conducted over tea and almonds, and that's how it's done. And I think that ties in very nicely to your second point about education. There's some very interesting research that was done by ARU on the National Solidarity Program, which showed that increasingly there's a role for young people in participatory politics, mainly because Afghans increasingly recognize the value and always have, but now opportunities exist for young people who are educated to engage in the process, and their inputs are considered equally valuable in many cases to those of traditional elders or religious leaders who, for other reasons of status, have been given priority in terms of the political process. So I think there's absolutely no question that in every sector that we've touched on, the education of youth and the inclusion of women, primarily first through education, will have an enormous impact on whether these processes can truly be owned by Afghans, and that the inputs of modernization and internationalization that are taking place can be sort of embraced in a slower and more gradual way through youth who tend to embrace those things rather than a clash that might otherwise take place.
One of my great concerns is a brief follow-up. There's a generation in the country that is extraordinarily important, and it's the young people who have come back from Pakistan. Mm-hmm. And they've come back with three marvelous attributes: English, computer skills, yep, and an understanding that there's a better world out there, even though it's Pakistan.
I just wanted to underscore the point about relationship building. I mean, the justice sector has been so plagued by a couple of factors, a lot of which come down to the relationship problem. Because while I do agree that our expectations for what can ultimately be achieved in something like the justice sector, which is really a long-term development question, whatever those expectations should be, we certainly have not met them in terms of our inputs. And part of the reason for that is the incredibly high turnover of people who go over to work on these issues. Even if they do start after 6 months to build relationships with their interlocutors, if they're able to do that, that's usually at least, you know, at best about halfway into the time that they're going to be spending in the country. People rarely even know what their predecessor did, let alone have some strategy of following up on it. And so in the areas like the justice sector that are the most sensitive to deal with, this problem is greatly exacerbated. On top of that, you know, anybody who does development work anywhere in the world knows that ultimately you're never going to get anywhere if you go in and tell people what to do. You have to convince them that this is what they want to do, build constituencies, turn it over to them to do it. In the case of Afghanistan, we have very much had a donor demand driven environment where the donors are coming in saying, this is what we want to spend our money on. These are the programs that we think should be the priorities. And even in some cases, and this is how we're going to do it, are you along for the ride? And very often the Afghans will say yes, and then nothing gets done because they don't agree with it and they undermine it. And it's just a fundamental point that I think bore emphasis. Well, I think that there are two ways of answering that question. Is it achievable in a legal sense, and is it achievable in a practical sense? In a legal sense, I think that the Constitution creates potential contradictions, but is not necessarily contradictory. So, for instance, Article 130 of the Constitution is the article that says that if there is no provision within Afghan law, the judges may refer to the Hanafi school of the Sharia for their interpretation. But it also adds that any outcome has to be in line with the Hanafi Sharia, in line with the rest of the Constitution, and in the best interests of justice. So there is a sort of balancing test that's established in that article, which any jurist needs to contemplate whether the decision that they would make ultimately satisfies all three of those criteria. And my argument would be, if you were weighing all of those criteria, that and I'm no Islamic Qadi, I'm no Islamic scholar, but from what I do know, and from what many of us have been reading a lot about apostasy rulings around the world in the last week, there certainly are voices out there that would allow those three things all to come together. In other words, a reading of the Sharia could comport with international values and could comport with fairness, because there are ways that you could interpret that and interpret the provisions specifically on apostasy to believe that it is ultimately the decision of the individual, and that decision is between him and his God, and whatever judgment there is passed, that judgment will not happen on this earth. And there are a lot of scholars who back that up. However, there are a lot of scholars who disagree with it. So legalistically, yes, I think there are ways to do it. Practically, it is clear from the last week that most people, at least those who are willing to speak out on this issue in Afghanistan, who have Islamic credentials, do not believe that those things are consonant with each other. They, in fact, believe that an apostate who was a Muslim and becomes a Christian should be put to death. And I believe that contradicts other aspects of the Constitution, which would suggest, in answer to your question, that the way the Constitution stands, then those things maybe can't be reconciled in the near term.
Let me just go down the table here. Yes.
My name is Christopher Broughton. I have a question I'd like to ask the panel about their opinion on the ethnic balance of power in the state. This was something which I think was an important concern of everyone post-2001. Primarily, you had Hajik and Uzbek dominated security apparatus within the state, and there were concerns about the alienation of Pashtun, the majority, if we believe the extrapolation of census data from the 1970s, which says that Pashtuns are a majority. And so I wanted to get your opinion in this post-parliamentary elections era that we're in about the ethnic balance of power in Afghanistan.
I mean, it's obviously an enormously important issue. The extent to which it is a very active part of politics became very clear during the constitutional Loya Jirga, and that extended into conceptions of how the state should be run as a result of that uncertain balance of power. And I think it is very uncertain in terms of, obviously, we don't have complete census data for Afghanistan. I think that some of the extrapolations that have been done is good, some of the preliminary numbers that have been good. The census data from the 1970s is discredited for a lot of reasons, both political and otherwise. And so I don't think that the parliamentary elections definitively answered the question of whether there is a Pashtun majority. Frankly, I don't think that it's a question that maybe is the best one to answer in the near term. I think that that what we're seeing in the parliament right now, and this is going to be the really interesting test, is whether people in fact do divide along ethnic lines or whether they divide along political lines. And because they haven't gotten to some of those meaty issues, and it's not an either-or situation. Sometimes they might vote one way, sometimes they might vote another way. But what was clear from the election, at least to the speaker, is that ethnic alliances are not everything. You cannot rely solely on ethnic alliances, or at least right now there are no politicians who have a strong enough ethnic base in order to capitalize on those ethnic alliances. A lot of these guys are so divisive that fortunately and happily, they're not able to become ethnic entrepreneurs in the way that we talked about in the Balkans, because they don't have the legitimacy within their own communities to galvanize everybody. And in my mind, that's a positive development. But I think it is still, at least as far as the parliament is concerned, a very open question as to whether ethnic alliances or other political or ideological ones are ultimately going to be the dominant force, if there is a dominant force. Because my fear is very much in line with the views of Marvin Weinbaum, which is that the greatest risk in this parliament is that it's going to be, just a factional melange that's never going to come together particularly well on every issue because there's such a great degree of division, and neither ethnicity nor ideology is likely to overcome that.
Just to jump off that point of Alex, I would say that, I mean, many people who have observed Afghan politics talk about how political parties have been associated in the minds of Afghans with a lot of negative points in their history. And there certainly were, the political party dynamic was rife with factionalism and associations with jihadi movements. And I think that this will be a very interesting time in the parliament, exactly as Alex said, to see if political parties can define themselves based on interests and platforms and agendas that actually cross those boundaries and allow for coalition building and a different level of political engagement in that sense that might do something to get at the question that you're asking.
Yes. Can you tell us who you are?
I'm sorry, Christine Harwell from the Department of State. And to talk about it, just one of the questions that was raised in terms of is it a sufficient framework for Afghan reconstruction? And how do you see the implementation and then hopefully eventually the evaluation of how it goes of working within Afghanistan?
How do we see the implementation of the ANDS?
Do you see it as possible? It's a document that was made by the Afghan government, and they're very, from what I understand, very proud of the fact that this is an Afghan document. I guess my question is, how far-reaching is this document, and how much do other Afghans know about it other than the government, for example? And is it something that's really got local ownership, a structure for that. So I guess it's an amazing document. How implementable is it? Where do you think it's actually going to go, if anywhere? Because we've based a lot, for, especially for the next 5 years on this.
Maybe I could just add something to that question, which is you've spoken about the need for tangible evidence. You've spoken about the lack of kind of measurable events. What might be some tangible evidence that this is actually moving, that this document is moving ahead, and that would give people those first signs of hope that it's something more than a piece of paper?
One of the first things that is already that already will happen is that there will be an increase on the administration of the international community money by the Afghan government. Right now, I think it's only 25% of the total money coming into Afghanistan, which is done by the government, and it's an important step forward to rely more on the legitimacy of the Afghan government and of course, work on the corruption issues, because it's usually the first concern of the international community in the donor conference while speaking about giving more responsibilities to the government. But I mean, that's a tangible element, and I think it's a good step. I mean, the Afghan government should deal more with the money that the international community is putting.
Thank you.
I was just going to say, I mean, I think that I grew up with the conception that five-year plans were a dirty word because they were usually indicative of bureaucratic impetus as opposed to certainly popular impetus. I mean, I very much saw the ANDS as the words behind the compact, and I think that the compact is critically important to Afghanistan's future insofar as getting the countries that are most engaged in Afghanistan on record and their leaders on record over and over again saying that they're going to retain their commitment to Afghanistan, that they're going to give money, that they're not going to pull out the troops is absolutely fundamental to making the project a success. And so in that sense, having a document that spells out what the hopes are in terms that we broadly understand, I think, is also very important. The extent to which that trickles down a step or two below the cabinet in Kabul, I'm frankly very skeptical of, both in terms of how the document was constructed, but also in terms of what likely outreach there's going to be about it and the ability of Afghans to assess whether the expectations that might be generated from this process are being met. And I don't think that that's a fault of the document per se, but it certainly is indicative, again, of what is driving development strategy in Afghanistan. It is a handful of people, and although half of them are Afghans, it doesn't reach down very far. And so my guess is that when you're talking about measurable impact, what it says in the ANDS is going to be of limited relevance. What I think will be much more relevant is the extent to which people actually believe that that they are receiving some services from the government and that the government is a legitimate one and that it's trying to do more. People will always complain about their government services, and so I don't think that there's going to be some surprise in 5 years that everybody's happy with the government. But at the moment, I don't think people think that the government is even necessarily the right vehicle to be delivering these services because they don't trust it. And that is really the critical barrier to overcome.
I think the concept of the PRTs, which is quite new in which is new actually in post conflict regions, had a time to adapt, which because it was a concept and because it was new, it had like a few years to actually be more empirical, to learn from itself, I guess. I personally think that the first, and it's implicit in what I said before, I think the first years was not very successful in terms of implementation because there were a lot of confusion and a lot of overlapping and lack of coordination. I believe, and again, I think this is because it was a new concept and they were like trying to fit into a different area. I think that right now is actually working better. That is working with the community, which is they are building things that, in coordination with other actors on the field, which was one of the main problems in the past. And it certainly looks like a model that tends to continue and maybe to expand into these theoretical frames of a post-conflict region.
I mean, I think I don't disagree, but I have a slightly different perspective, and that is that I think that so long as the PRTs remain predominantly a military vehicle, then their involvement in governance questions will remain deeply problematic. The extent to which the military, foreign military, is seen as being an interlocutor between people and their government is something that we should avoid at all costs. And yet, because of the gap that exists in government, because the provincial level government does not act as an interlocutor between people in Kabul, foreign military, I shouldn't say the foreign military, the foreign governments have decided that something needs to help to boost this role. But the problem is that the character primarily of the PRTs so far has still been a military one, weighted far more towards the military than the civilian. I certainly think that it is a powerful idea to get civilian political and donor actors out to the provincial level to provide, to work with provincial government on a daily basis to increase their capacity, to increase their budget, and their ability to deliver services is fundamental, and it's probably one of the best things that could be done. But that hasn't really been what the character of the PRTs has been in Afghanistan so far. PRTs have been a crazy mixture, and it's always difficult to talk about them because if you're talking about 15 PRTs, you're talking about 15 different enterprises. But a lot of the PRTs have primarily been places where they're co-located military forces, some still engaging in war on terror-like operations that are trundling out of the same gate as the guys who are in their flak jackets and helmets, but they're not in armored vehicles, they're in land cruisers, and they're going out to give money to a school. I don't think that that's what we want the face of government to be in Afghanistan. I applaud the idea of the PRTs, but I think as far as implementation is concerned, when you talk about governance, you really need to talk about a fundamentally sort of reimagined approach to what the PRTs are doing.
Just a short thing. I think that's I agree with that, and that's why the PRT's role should be limited to the post-conflict period, because it was probably very difficult for USAID to establish to support governance in host in 2003, and having the PRTs was an alternative that, I mean, with any results, was something that tangible and something that maybe it was no other possible approach at the moment. And this is why I think it should be limited by the post-conflict or by a certain period.
I mean, let me just add, security, yes. But we're talking about things that go well beyond security and the standing up of security forces. As far as security forces are concerned, absolutely they should be playing a role, and it's a critical one. They should have done it earlier. But when we get into other questions of governance is what I was talking about.
Let us take two more questions. I'll finish with you, Mr. Minister, and why don't you go next?
I just want to make a quick follow-up comment on the PRTs. Stan Byers with USAID and former PRT officer. You have to follow, emphasize what Alex was saying, all the PRTs are very different, and every situation is different. You can't talk about the PRTs as a model. There is no one model of them. To the point of how relevant they are to government, I mean, there's some fundamental things that you have to follow. One of them is not be the facto government, but push away from being the facto government as much as possible. And the other is to focus on security, because that's the foundation for everything else. If you can do that, those two things, everything else becomes conditional to what region you're in, what the other actors are, what kind of capacity you have to deal with, who the international actors are. To say, should you get involved with government, should you get involved with helping build up capacity, or is the PRT not the right model for that in that situation? In other places, it may not be, you need to stay away from it. You need to be asking the right questions as opposed to saying, we're going to do this, and this with the PRTs, but more than each situation, trying to figure out where can we add value here and where should we be stepping back.
Thanks. Mr. Minister, last question.
Thank you very much for the comments. And I agree with many things that you said here. However, with due respect to all the statement is I was not sure about something that you said, whether you were talking about Afghanistan or another country somewhere in the world. To start with, we have to realize that the international community did not go to Afghanistan to build that country or to rebuild that country. If that was the case, the international community could go there in 1992 to rebuild it at a much lower cost. It went there to destroy the terrorist network in the regime that sponsored the terrorists. Now, of course, after the collapse of the Taliban regime and the breakup of the Al-Qaeda network in Afghanistan, it was realized that unless you rebuild this country, if you don't go to Afghanistan, Afghanistan will come back to you. So therefore, that was after the collapse of the Taliban, then let's rebuild this country. However, despite that fact, the initial military intervention continues to cast a long shadow on the development of Afghanistan. After the Taliban collapse, you saw a country devastated, destroyed for 30 years. Everybody destroyed it. First, a superpower, the Soviet Union, came and invaded that small country. And then the other superpower came to save that country, the poor country. So they were pulling this country in different directions. And then we imagine if the two superpowers are pulling the same way, how much the devastation did it cause. And then later on, that was the smallest, poorest Islamist country, and these Islamist groups came to destroy that small country in order to impose their own ideology that was totally against that. After that war, we had many challenges, destruction everywhere. All aspects are rather destroyed. But then, if you fix one aspect, if you do not at the same time do something for the other aspect, which are all interconnected, you cannot achieve much. They're all interconnected. Lack of progress in one area affects progress in another area. Now, this one question. Then you saw actors coming from different parts of the world, with different levels of commitment, different level of resources, and also domestic agendas, big projects too. So how you coordinate all this, how you link all the different aspects of the challenges, and how you respond, and they can, and in many cases, they operate across purposes. So therefore, we have to take this into consideration. The Bonn process, the Bonn Accord, was dominated by an international agenda for security. Unless now this changes, that it is a development agenda based on Afghan needs, you are not going to go anywhere. A failed Afghanistan is in a globalizing world is no longer an option. So, just coming back, I don't want to take much of your time with the last question, the PRT. 3 years I was the chairman of the Steering Executive Committee of PRT. PRT started not as a mechanism like Alex says to talk to people for the government. It was a security element. It started by the coalition. It actually emerged from civil military units for stabilization operation in areas where military operation, the central government did not have much influence, and warlords were in charge. And to come back to this statement that initially it was weak, and then later on they became very powerful, that's the opposite. Initially, the PRTs and Gardaist, PRT and Mazar helped me a lot in providing bringing stability to the situation. Because if a PRT, is successful only when it is a tip of an iceberg. The iceberg is a military structure. If you do not have that structure, the PRT is an isolated outpost somewhere in the wonderland. So therefore, PRT cannot be dissociated from the military command, military structure, and therefore civilization of the PRT is not an option. The moment you civilize the PRT, then you should better go to the government, because then you do not need that kind of a stabilizing factor there. Later on, when the pressure came for ISAF
to expand beyond Kabul. Conveniently, NATO adopted this PRT without having that structure that the coalition forces had. So you have PRTs, small PRTs, in northern Afghanistan, established by ISAF without a strong operational capacity. So what they did, they tried to accommodate or protect themselves. In many cases, some PRTs who came from some countries, they would protect themselves more than providing service. So it was actually serving the provider rather than customer. And different countries came, from Germany to Italy to Lithuania to the other countries. They came with different countries, different resources. Now the question is, when the NATO expand to the south, this has been yesterday, we were at the discussion with Minister Chetin, the senior NATO representative. He said it is going to change. NATO will change it, but it is different. We're fighting by a country, by the United States, is one thing. Fighting by a commission is a different thing, composed of 26 nations. And they have different agendas. Now, this is going to be tested. There's a PRT that's going to be established in the south. This will give the new, attribution to the PRT.
Great. Thank you very much. Do any of you need a last word? We've gone a little bit beyond our time. Do you feel a final bouquet you'd like to share with us? All right. Thank you all very much, and join me in thanking the panel.
Thank you.